Welcome to the InfoQ podcast, a software engineering podcast brought to you by the same team behind InfoQ.com. InfoQ.com is a software engineering news site which aims to help progressive software development teams adopt new technologies. InfoQ also brings you QCon, the International Software Conferences. I'm Barry Bird, a professor at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. I'm speaking with Shuman Gosmajunder. He's Vice President of Product Management at Shape Security and former click fraud czar at Google. He's the co-author of CGI Programming Unleashed, a contributing author to CrimeWave, and a regular guest lecturer at Stanford University. Shuman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
You say that the pace of data breaches has increased over the past decade. In your opinion, why has it increased? Is it mainly a technological change, or can we attribute it to some larger cultural changes?
I think that it's a combination of the two. So as society has moved increasingly online, I think that's simply where business is being transacted, and that's where people's lives are being conducted, and that's one of the reasons that you see criminals also starting to focus on using technology, because that's simply the way that they get to people. But in addition to the fact that there's been this societal shift, I think that there's also been a technological shift. So when you have more of our lives conducted online through technology and information retrieval systems, all of a sudden the use of advanced technology gives criminals the opportunities to be able to do things that they weren't able to do in the old model of crime. So in the past, if a criminal wanted to go and burgle someone's house, then that was something that was a very difficult activity for them to be able to scale. Whereas using technology now, it's possible for them to essentially burgle the equivalent of thousands of houses simultaneously using automation tools that allow them to be able to distribute their attack in a very efficient way.
What about these people who call me on the phone? Say that if I log onto my computer and do certain things, then they'll be able to fix my computer. Isn't that a very work-intensive way of stealing things from me
Absolutely.
In the modern age?
Absolutely.
How do the economics of that work?
You know, it's a fascinating area. There are so many different types of cybercrime and fraud that different groups are engaged in. And I've gotten those calls myself, and it's fascinating to see the steps that they go through and the different types of social engineering that they engage in to try and persuade you to do different things on your computer that will then give them access. And I think that it really depends on the nature of the cybercriminal and the value of the targets that they're after when they're figuring out what type of scheme they want to engage in. So if you're talking about getting at some data that's very valuable and you know, you're willing to invest significant amounts in order to be able to get that value, then that lends itself to different types of technology and different numbers of people involved and different amounts of manual effort than something where you're trying to get at data that may have a much lower amount of value per transaction. So for example, if there's an individual that you want to get access to in terms of being able to take over their computer, then the way that you would be willing to invest in that particular scheme in terms of social engineering, in terms of maybe even malware that you would custom design for that individual, that would be very different than a scheme that doesn't care which individuals you're necessarily breaching and can just be distributed across thousands of different machines. So I think that there are different paths through which professional cyber criminals get into particular fraud schemes. In some cases, they become familiar with one industry and then they start attacking that and developing advanced tools to be able to create those attacks more efficiently. In other cases, I think that they just see that there's an opportunity that's available. And in those cases, you would expect that there would be a much greater concentration of effort in the most efficient types of cybercrime as opposed to the ones that are more manual, like you were just mentioning. But we continue to see that there are some cybercriminals that are engaged in schemes that might be more expensive from the point of view of the attacker.
So I think you're saying that I should be flattered that I'm receiving these calls. I'm a worthwhile customer.
Maybe. I think that in a number of different cases, they've discovered that there's simply enough value in their scheme that they don't stop it entirely, so they continue to run something that might not be as efficient as another cyber criminal scheme, but maybe they're simply not aware of a different area of cybercrime that they could be investing in right now.
So now, who are these people who are calling me? Who are the actual callers or the actual grunts involved in a cybercrime? And who are the people who are the big people in charge? What's their profile? What kind of person should I imagine behind the phone call or behind the keyboard?
There are all kinds of different personalities and demographics involved. So cybercriminals come from all over the world. They come from every single socioeconomic background that you can think of, as long as there's some level of access to computers and technology. But even in cases where a cybercriminal doesn't know how to use technology directly themselves or know how to create something like a piece of malware, they can still be involved in a cybercriminal scheme. So, for example, you've seen different signs, I'm sure, on intersections that say work from home for $5,000 a week, no questions asked. As you can imagine, in many cases, those are cyber criminals that are actually recruiting individuals to do things that don't require questions being asked. And I think that one of the things that people don't realize is that that is part of a much more complex ecosystem that enables cybercrime. So in that particular case, one of the schemes that uses large groups of individuals that don't necessarily need to have skills themselves is stealing money from bank accounts. So being able to transfer money using malware on people's machines from one account to another account that the cybercriminal controls still involves getting that money out. And that last step can involve a set of bank accounts that are assigned to real individuals. So if you have a set of real individuals who can then perform repetitive manual actions for you, they don't need to be computer experts in order for you to be able to fulfill that last mile of your cybercrime.
Will those real individuals know that they're engaging in criminal activity, or might they typically not have any idea?
I think that varies too. I think that that's sort of the nature of no questions asked. So if you're willing to be highly compensated for something that doesn't want to be individuals involved don't want to be scrutinized too carefully, you probably have a sense that you're doing something that may not be completely legitimate. But in other cases, you can enlist the help of anonymous people on the internet in order to be able to provide you with resources to perpetrate a cybercrime. So in the case of building up botnets and compromising millions of people's machines unbeknownst to them, that's a type of scheme where the individuals who are providing those resources have no idea that their machines have even been involved. Or in other cases, if they're solving things like CAPTCHAs online, for those who aren't familiar with CAPTCHAs, the little squiggly challenges that come up when you're trying to log into
the
your
ones that are
accounts.
Even difficult for me as a human to read.
That's
you mean?
That's right. That,
yes.
That's the point that they've evolved to now. Those can be solved using a combination of programmatic and manual efforts. So you can actually take CAPTCHAs that you can't solve using optical character recognition as a cybercriminal, and instead farm them out to millions of users as a challenge that's issued to them to be able to get content behind a paywall.
Is there anything in general you can say about the profile of the consumer fraud person, the person who goes after a consumer fraud, calls me or sends me spam email and wants me to send millions of dollars to some foreign country, versus the kind of fraud that a large company would be watching for? So, for instance, is there a difference in the are there differences between the kind of fraud that a large company has to watch out for versus a consumer and the kind of operation that's behind it?
Sure. I think that there's a very strong overlap between the two, in the sense that there are, of course, many companies that serve millions of customers. And in those cases, what cybercriminals are trying to do is get access to those customers' accounts and the value behind those accounts. And then it becomes an issue for both the customers themselves as well as for the company that's providing that service. So if somebody can get access to your bank account, That's an issue for you. It's also an issue for your bank. So both of you are trying to work to prevent that. But it can be exceedingly difficult, of course, and there are different things that each of you are capable of looking for or are interested in looking for. So, for example, in the case of an individual, you're going to be very concerned if you see that there are any anomalies associated with your bank balances. So you're probably going to look at that very carefully and figure out whether or not you have the general amount of money that you expect to have in your bank account on a regular basis. But for the bank, that's not sufficient. They need to be able to look at indicators of fraud that wouldn't necessarily be visible to the naked eye of an individual, because one of the ways that cyber criminals can steal money is in much smaller chunks at a time. So if you start to see patterns of smaller transactions that are being executed across a large number of accounts, then that's an example of a type of fraud that an automated fraud detection system that a bank might be using might be able to detect that a human looking at their own bank account might not necessarily spot. And in fact, from your point of view, if someone broke into your account and stole 50 cents and that was all they did, maybe you wouldn't be that concerned about it. But the fact is that that same mechanism could potentially be used to steal more money. And certainly from the bank's point of view, that mechanism writ large could be used to steal money from many different accounts.
So the banks are running heuristics that look for small changes over a wide number of accounts and other changes that the single consumer wouldn't detect.
As an example. And they're looking for signs of many different types of fraud schemes. So in some cases, it's not even money that's directly stolen out of someone's account that is the giveaway. It's the act of just logging into the account and checking to see whether or not you have credentials that are valid on that account. That could then allow the cyber criminal to be able to sell those credentials to someone else who actually has the intent of stealing money out of the account in some more sophisticated scheme. And this is something that you see across every industry that has to deal with accounts, that has to deal with any type of data that has value that cyber criminals may be trying to steal. So you see them going through and looking for valid credentials, checking credentials that they've stolen or purchased from underground markets to see whether or not they're valid on the sites that they actually want to breach. And there are many different tools, many different schemes, and many different indicators of that type of security issue or fraud that organizations need to look for now.
When a website shows me a picture in order for me to log in, is this your picture? I usually ignore it. Why should I not ignore it?
Well, the intent behind that is for you to use that essentially like an additional factor for authentication. So you then see this picture that presumably only you and the bank know is associated with your account, and it gives you an additional level of assurance that this really is your bank's website that you're logging into, and presumably that you've authenticated one step already to be able to see that. Maybe you've got a cookie on your machine that indicates that there's a relationship between your browser and that bank's web server. But the fact is that most people behave exactly the way that you just described. So if a cyber criminal spoofs that bank's website and shows you everything associated with the general login mechanism but doesn't have that picture, the vast majority of users don't worry about that and they'll continue to enter their password into that spoofed website nonetheless.
Has the picture method been known to prevent some kinds of fraud in certain situations?
Well, if you see that it's missing the picture, and that alarms you, and then you go and investigate, and then maybe you discover that your machine has been compromised, or you contact the bank and you discover a fraud scheme, then of course it has the capability to help in that sense. And there are instances where things like that have happened. However, for the most part, considering that millions of users will just completely ignore the lack of that picture and log in anyway, it demonstrates that it doesn't provide a lot of efficacy for the cost that's involved.
So is a cyber criminal who's trying to steal from a company more likely to be a well-educated criminal than someone who's trying to steal from a consumer? I picture the difference between people trying to hack General Motors and people trying to hack Barry Bird.
Yeah.
Is this the case?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that you see organized cybercrime focused on large companies is because of the fact that they get a much greater sense of efficiency for their attacks when they go to one particular mechanism that has a lot of value behind it. So if you can figure out a way to be able to breach a single website that has millions of users' account values or millions of users' data that you can then steal and sell on underground markets, then that's a very efficient type of attack versus having to compromise millions of users' machines directly.
But it takes more smarts. That's what I'm suspecting, and that's what I'm asking is, does it take a smarter, more sophisticated cyber criminal to even attempt such an attack?
Well, what I was going to say was that in the past, you might have thought that there would be a greater level of capability and education on the part of cyber criminal organizations that are concentrating on those corporate types of attacks. But I think now you see factors that balance that on both sides. So, for example, there can be a lot of sophistication associated with compromising individual end users. So being able to create that malware that's able to get through all of the antivirus and all of the network level filters that people have in place and compromise millions of machines, that's not something that's technologically trivial. And at the same time, there are tools available that allow even script kiddies to be able to attack large corporations in very successful ways. So I think that you're seeing both sophisticated and unsophisticated cyber criminals engaged in both types of activities now.
Is there anything in the larger culture, not just the technological culture, that's contributed in recent years to the increase in cybercrime?
Well, like I said, I think that the fact that so much of our lives are now conducted online makes people think about what opportunities does that create from a fraud perspective. And so cyber criminals are getting creative. They're coming up with ways to be able to interact with websites that we hadn't even thought of before and might not be thinking of from an application developer perspective. I think that they're coming up with schemes that we haven't thought of from the perspective of being users. So because of that, I think that we're constantly getting surprised with new types of attacks. And, you know, we're thinking that, you know, this isn't something that we even fathomed when we started using a given service. Like, what does it mean for, you know, this service to have my credentials, for example? So relating to the types of attacks that I was mentioning that use automation, I think that people haven't really thought a lot about how using the same password across multiple sites can make them extremely vulnerable. So let's say that the message has sunk in, that it's important for you to create a secure password. So your password's no longer password 123, but instead it's something that has uppercase letters and is 15 characters long and has some punctuation marks in it, something that's pretty much unguessable and something that an attacker wouldn't be able to break using brute force techniques. If you take that very strong password and then use it across multiple sites, let's say you've got the same password that you're using for your banking site as you're using for a social network, and that social network has much more lax security than the banking site does. If that social network gets breached and your password gets out, now cyber criminals are going to take that list of breached passwords and test it on every single other website that they want to attack, including your banking site, and now all of a sudden they can access your bank account.
So is it safe to use a dumb password for sites that I don't consider especially meaningful to me?
You know, it's also not safe to use a dumb password anywhere, I think, but the key thing is that you have to use different passwords across all of your sites. And that's something that's that introduces a lot of cognitive burden. So one of the things that I've noticed that's kind
Since they say don't write down your password
that's
anywhere.
Right. That's right. There's no really good answer to this right now because even password managers have been shown to be breachable. So if you've got a password manager that you're using to generate a unique password on every single website that you access, and that password manager gets breached by a cyber criminal, now all of a sudden they have a nicely structured data set of all of your usernames and passwords that they can use to be able to access your accounts in a way that would be more difficult for them to obtain if you'd just written it down in a text file, for example.
Or just kept it in paper in my drawer.
That's right.
So what?
Which are also not secure or recommended.
Well, I assume that it's more time-consuming and more costly for them to get into my drawer in my living room than to get on my computer and find a text file with my passwords.
Right, and you know, that's the nature of different attacks and different incentives that people have. So if you're primarily concerned about people that you know getting access to your accounts, then you probably don't want to put your passwords in a drawer. If you're concerned primarily about cyber criminals on the other side of the world, then you probably don't want to have your passwords in a text file on your computer, and so on.
So what are people doing about this password problem? Different passwords everywhere that are difficult for cyber criminals to access, but possible for the average human being to access? How to do that?
You know, they're doing all kinds of different things. And when you ask people throughout the security industry what they do personally, you get all kinds of different answers. So some people have evolved their own password formula systems that they keep memorized with various mnemonics, and they have different levels of security for different types of websites, like you were mentioning, for sites that you don't care about as much, you have a less difficult mnemonic, and for sites that you care about more, you have something that would be even difficult for you to be able to guess without that mnemonic. So I think that in other cases, you see that the best compromise for a lot of users is actually using a password manager that takes care of a lot of that complexity for you. But what we still see, unfortunately, throughout account systems and throughout the security industry is rampant reuse of pretty simple passwords. So every time there's a breach plain texts of passwords are actually published, you see that the vast majority of users are using passwords that aren't that strong. And in fact, there's a plurality of users that are using ridiculously simple passwords still, like password 123.
What about biometric techniques?
They can help, but there are certainly trade-offs that are associated with those as well. So for example, if you have biometric techniques that can cause false positives, say for example a fingerprint scanner that doesn't necessarily provide a one-to-one correspondence in terms of someone being able to authenticate themselves and an attacker being able to authenticate themselves, then that's something that isn't going to be a replacement for a password mechanism.
Your talk here at QCon is about security war stories. Without asking you to repeat your talk, can you share the gist of one of those stories with us in this podcast?
Well, you'll have to go to the keynote to be able to hear the full story, but basically what I'm going to be talking about in one of those stories is how you can have very large-scale attacks that are completely invisible from the point of view of the application that's being attacked. And this is one of the things that's so different about protecting an application in 2016 versus 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I think that there are so many different ways that people interact with applications. There are so many different demographics and sources of traffic that it's very difficult to be able to understand whether or not someone is a real user or whether or not they're actually an attacker. And that's an opportunity that attackers use to be able to create a scale of attack that can be breathtaking while simultaneously pretty much invisible to even very sophisticated defenders. So I think that there are many different examples of this, but you see this constantly across different websites where and across mobile applications as well, where there are large sets of traffic that are coming into those applications that you're not quite sure what they're doing, but at the same time, you're not confident enough that you're able to block them. So I think that you have to try and get all of the information that you can, but this is really an area where we're still playing cat and mouse with attackers.
In the majority of time, can you recognize an attack after it's been done? Or are there attacks that are so devious, so clever, so veiled that you don't even know the damage has been done until much later?
Well, I think that that's one of the most difficult things about this area, that yes, you can discover many different attacks after they've occurred and you can learn from those discoveries, but you are only aware of what you have become aware of. So you can do the best job that you can of doing those types of retrospective analyses, but What about the things that you didn't catch? What about the attackers that were able to make it through, and even years later, they were never caught in any of the investigations that you did? So what damage can they cause? And you know, this is something that you see examples of throughout the security industry, pieces of malware that were in the wild for years before anyone in the entire industry discovered them.
So are there pieces of malware that have not been publicized that the industry knows about but the general public hasn't been made aware of?
Oh, I think that that's a very different type of issue, because now you're getting into the question of disclosure and the responsibility of security companies. And in general, I think that you see a very strong mindset throughout the security industry that if there is something that is a great risk to the general public, then people want to disclose that as quickly as possible.
So as a security guru, you're constantly leapfrogging your opponents. They're coming up with ideas, you're coming up with ideas to counter them. They're coming up with new ideas, you're coming up with other ideas. Does this job become tiresome for that reason? You're constantly dueling with a certain group of people, group of cyber criminals. You're not dealing with an honest crowd here.
Yeah, I think that that's something that is actually part of what attracts people to the security industry. I think that the opportunity to be able to protect people using sophisticated techniques that are staying ahead of cyber criminals, and being able to take the battle to cyber criminals in terms of seeing if you can outsmart them, I think that that's very appealing intellectually for a lot of folks. And also, it's part of the mission orientation that a lot of people have to being able to protect their peers and their families and society at large.
But you're always fighting.
You are.
You have an opponent. When you're developing software and making sure that the software isn't buggy, the bugs are going to come up, but they're not going to come up as persistently. They're not going to come up so intentionally. Does the intentionality of the attack ever bother you?
Well, I think that that is what makes it so interesting intellectually. So the attacks that cyber criminals are going to come up with are going to be much more sophisticated than bugs that you would just encounter in the process of application development. So I think that if you really want to have a difficult intellectual challenge, then the security industry offers a lot in that area. And you know, that also brings out people's competitive natures. You want to be able to take the best that the cyber criminal world has to offer and see if you can stay ahead of it.
Is there a way to look at a piece of software and rule out 99% of the vulnerabilities?
Not really. I think that the big challenge there is, how do you measure something like a percentage of vulnerabilities? Because you can have one single vulnerability that has a massive impact in terms of whether or not that application is actually secure, versus just a large set of vulnerabilities that may not be a big deal for that particular application depending on what it's trying to do. So that measurement itself is very difficult. There's also a challenge in terms of being able to come up with a list of vulnerabilities that's going to be anywhere near complete. How do you figure out the things that you aren't aware of right now that are vulnerabilities that you have no way of measuring? And then there are problems of being able to do both manual and automatic analysis of code. So, you know, whether you're doing static analysis or dynamic analysis or going through security review in an SDLC, I think that all of those are limited types of mechanisms, and it's difficult for you to go through any of them and conclude that something is 99.9% secure.
So understanding that there's no way of measuring these things exactly, how much of a security auditor's work is a manual task versus an automatic task?
Well, I think that there are important roles for both of those types of mechanisms to play. But the main thing to keep in mind is that you're only going to be able to get a certain level of assurance by doing those types of audits. I think that the fundamental design of the application and the business purpose for it, or the logical purpose for it, is something that is difficult for a general auditing mechanism to be able to take into account. And that's where you need to have greater education from a security standpoint across all levels of an organization. So you have to have the business owners and the software developers and the folks that are working in finance and the folks that are working in risk all working together to be able to figure out what really is the level of risk that's associated with a given application or piece of software, and therefore how confident do we need to be that certain mechanisms are vulnerable or are not vulnerable or not secure.
If I'm coming to you with a piece of software and I'd like you to give me an opinion on the level of security of that software, how vulnerable it is, are there things that I can do before you show up that would help you do your job in a better way?
Well, so I think that you can certainly look at certain things from the point of view of how a piece of code is constructed to be able to say, yes, this is correct, or yes, this is incorrect. However, like I was saying, the bigger context of what are you using that software for is also critically important. It's probably even more important than just going through and understanding the code level vulnerabilities. I think that the discussion is really something that goes beyond security, the way that we think about it in terms of IT security, which is generally more vulnerability focused, and it gets into issues that in some cases are classified as fraud more than security. So how can this application be used in unintended ways that are often beyond the scope of a typical security audit?
Are some pieces of software easier to audit than others?
Well, the smaller it is, I suppose, I think that makes it a less complex task. But at the same time, I think that most pieces of software that people would want to do security audit on are sufficiently complex that it's still difficult to get to 100% certainty.
Are there certain kinds of software? Are there certain elements in software that make it particularly vulnerable?
Well, I think that one of the real challenges associated with software development in 2016 is the complexity of the stack that we're using to be able to create any type of application these days. So being able to understand whether or not a given component is secure is a much more constrained type of task than figuring out whether or not that component is going to be capable of interacting with all of the other components in a system in a guaranteed secure fashion. So I think that, you know, that, as you can imagine, starts to turn into a very difficult and complex problem that, in many cases, would create massive scope creep in terms of a security review.
But I understand then that you're not going to do me the pleasure of fingering a particular kind of component.
No, I think that you know, every single kind of component has different types of vulnerabilities that are associated with that fall into these sorts of categories. It's all about and you know, cyber criminals surprise you in these ways. That whenever you look at Pwn2Own, for example, there are different types of exploits that people pick through that come from components where you wouldn't expect there to be a vulnerability. And I think that that's really what the challenge is, that if you can identify a vulnerability in a component that everyone else generally thinks to be secure because it's gone through all of these audits, in many cases it's been used by millions of developers for an extended number of years. You look at Heartbleed, for example. I think that you know, that's something that you know, people just weren't looking there and they didn't expect to find a vulnerability there, and all of a sudden that's something that can create a very large-scale issue for society.
I once read that no system can be considered completely secure unless it's reached its end of life and experienced no security failures. Do you agree with this?
Well, even if it's reached end of life and experienced no security failures, that doesn't necessarily mean that it was secure or is secure. So I think that...
For practical purposes, though.
Well, so if something has reached end of life, I think that for practical purposes, you know, there are no more security issues because no one is using it or supporting it anymore. And I think that that gets to the general nature of what it means to be secure. It's always a question of expense and trade-offs. It's never a question of absolutes, because if you want to achieve absolute security, there is a way to be able to do that, and that's simply turn off that application or not make it available or you know, cut the power to a system. If you, on the other hand, want that application to be accessible and you want that system to be connected to other systems, then you have to decide how much are you willing to invest in preventing that system from being breached or misused in various ways. And so for every single mechanism that you can think of for preventing an attack, there's probably some type of expensive answer that an attacker could come up with if they really wanted to breach that system. Often it can branch into social engineering, or it can branch into coming up with a vulnerability for a component or an exploit for a component that you didn't think there was a vulnerability within. And there are diminishing returns associated with you continuing to invest in security in all of those mechanisms yourself. So if you spent an additional $1 million to be able to secure a component, would that guarantee that it was secure? Maybe, maybe not. It might give you a lot more reassurance. If you spent $1 billion more securing that component, thinking about all of the stack that's associated with that, would you be able to achieve 100% security? No, you wouldn't.
And would it be worth it?
Exactly. That's the question.
As a security expert, do you have to carry a lot of liability insurance? What happens if some of your work turns out to not be as secure as you intended it to be?
Well, I think that the nature of different companies in the security industry vary. So we, as a company, are not going and auditing people's security systems, for example. What we do is we provide technology that allows them to be able to protect their applications more effectively. So, you know, that's something where we are constantly engaged in the cat and mouse game and staying ahead of attackers. And in terms of the value that we're providing to companies, that's something that they can directly measure. So it's a slightly different portion of the industry that way.
Would you say that security auditing and security in general is as much an art as it is a science?
In a lot of ways, absolutely.
Do some people have a flair for it? And what gives them that flair? What's the inner spark?
You know, I think the desire to really understand the mistakes that people can make when creating software, the desire to stay ahead of what other very smart people that are acting against them are doing, the desire to be able to protect individuals and society. I think that there are all kinds of different factors that motivate people to get into the security industry. And
have you ever met someone where you can apply the phrase, it takes a thief to catch a thief?
I think that it is an area where you have to be able to relate to your opponents, for sure. You have to be able to think like they do in order to be able to anticipate what their next move is going to be. But you also want to be extremely careful in how you engage with folks that have knowledge of those types of areas. So, you know, you've seen that there are large numbers of white hat security folks that are very squarely focused on being able to develop security technologies to be able to protect society. But there are also gray hats that are out there that work with security firms by day in some cases, and in other cases they find opportunities to be able to do less savory things at night. And, you know, as a security company in general, you want to be able to guard against those types of individuals and only engage with white hats.
So what's on the next on the horizon for security? What's the future look like?
Well, I think much more sophistication, much more discussion at all levels of organizations. I think that we've seen that security has become a boardroom level issue now for companies, especially as they're engaged with more online activity in the course of their regular businesses. And I think that security is becoming interesting to the mainstream, not just folks in the technology industry, but even people outside of technology. So I think that there's a great potential for there to be much more sophistication in terms of the technology that's going to be created by the security industry in the next few years, and by everyone when it comes to security innovations. And that's something that is extremely necessary because of all of the innovation that has been going on in the last 10 plus years on the side of cyber criminals.
Are there innovations that we should be watching out for?
Well, I think that there are many exciting things that are coming from security startups as well as from large companies like Google's Project Zero, I think, is a great example of real desire to be able to make a difference in the security industry. Our own technology at Shape Security has been making a very large difference in terms of being able to deal with these large-scale automated attacks. I think that being able to put up defenses in general across various industries that allow us to be able to deal with attacks that are currently capable of breaching websites and applications with relative ease. I think that's something that's an important innovation. But I think that we're also seeing innovation in ways that consumers can directly appreciate. So the introduction of Touch ID by Apple into iPhones. I think that that was a great innovation in terms of being the first time that fingerprint technology was installed as a default option on the standard platform that hundreds of millions of people use.
Will we be living in a more technologically secure world in the next several decades, or will we just keep trading off back and forth with cyber criminals?
You know, I think that just like the real world, you can never achieve 100% security, so you can never say that we are secure in an absolute sense. However, I do think that everyone is becoming much more security-minded when it comes to how they use technology and how they think about the security of the systems that they rely upon. So there will always be this cat and mouse between good guys and bad guys. And that's probably even more true in the world of technology than it is in the real world, where you've got the additional mechanisms of anonymity and large-scale deployment of technology that allow anyone to be an attacker from anywhere in the world and attack anyone as a victim. But I think that when everyone recognizes how these types of attacks can happen, then they can also take measures and insist that the companies that they work with also take measures to be able to protect them.
You've been listening to the InfoQ podcast. I'm Barry Bird. I've been speaking with Shuman Gosmajumdar, the Vice President of Product Management at Shape Security. Shuman, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.